I always enjoy coming to Perimeter. Today I'm going to attempt to tell you to sketch a conceptual route by which we can start from qubits, which really for me just means some completely well-defined, regulated degrees of freedom, which obey the ordinary rules of quantum mechanics. How we can go from such a starting point all the way to Einstein's equations in some kind of semi-classical space. And of course, I won't really make a completely airtight case, but I hope to at least sketch a conceptual route and to tell you about some new and important results along the way. This is a work with Mark van Remstonk, and you can read about the second half of the talk in this first paper, and the first half will appear soon. And at least the second half really owes a lot to recent work by Mark and his collaborators, and also Rob Myers and his collaborators, and is spiritually at least very similar to the old work of Jacobson, obtaining Einstein's equations as some kind of thermodynamic relation. So we'll see all that as we go along. So let me just begin. My background is condensed matter, so I'm going to be as naive as possible about gravity, which I'm not supposed to know anything about, at least quantum gravity. So what makes gravity interesting and special? Well, the first observation that we learned, that Newton taught us, is that in a gravitational system, you can measure the total energy of the system at infinity, right, by studying the motion of test masses, thinking about Minkowski space. So there's a sense in which the Hamiltonian is really something that's kind of defined asymptotically, which is very different from a condensed matter system without gravity, because there I can't know what the energy of the whole system is by only making a measurement at infinity. So this suggests that Hamiltonian is really some kind of boundary thing. The second clue, I would say, comes from the Bekenstein-Hawking formula for black hole entropy, which says that, you know, black holes have some kind of entropy which behaves thermodynamically in a very reasonable way, and that entropy is proportional to their area, not to their volume. So again, this is a kind of clue that in quantum gravity or in gravity, the degrees of freedom are living on boundaries and not so much in bulks. Okay. So if we take point one and two together, they suggest that quantum gravity could be understood as some kind of system living on the boundary, which generates the space or the space-time in some unspecified way. And then the question you want to ask is, so what is the interpretation of this emerged direction? And again, a very naive perspective is to say, well, if I had like a star, say, of some big mass M, and I had a little atom which emits photons of some frequency E naught when it was out in infinity, then when I bring that atom in close to the star and it emits a photon which goes out to infinity, the energy that I measure at infinity is smaller than the energy of the atom that the atom would emit at infinity. Right? And this is really just essentially saying in Newtonian language that I have to climb out of the potential well for this photon to reach infinity. And so this suggests that you should interpret the sort of radial direction here as corresponding to energy scale as measured in boundary degrees of freedom. Right. So this is, you know, for quantum gravity aficionados, this is all painfully obvious, but I want to say that this is just like some kind of vague motivation for the construction we're going to attempt. So the microphysical starting point is to take this holographic principle of Etuft and Susskind and so forth, many other people, very seriously, to start with some completely well-defined, regulated, quantum mechanically rules-obeying degrees of freedom in one fewer dimension, and then to try to build up a space from these degrees of freedom. And the second important statement is that since I said that the radial direction is like energy scale, in order to have a big space, we're going to need to have degrees of freedom at all energy scales, right? So that suggests that we should look for a CFT, at least to develop a sort of large space-time. And then finally, you know, what does entanglement have to do with anything? And I would say the area law for entanglement entropy, which is a property of quantum ground states and local Hamiltonians, is a very suggestive statement. And in fact, you know, going back even to Sorkin and others, this has been suggested as part of or all of black hole entropy. But so if we wanted to maybe take this suggestion very seriously and really elevate this area law to some kind of dynamical principle, and we're going to have some kind of dynamical geometry. That is, whatever area is doing the calculating of the entanglement entropy has to depend on the state, because different states have different entropy. So we have to have a dynamical geometry come out of this story. And so what I want to do is to start in the middle and give you a kind of signpost, which is going to be where we're going to start from qubits and get to this point, and then, or at least try to make it plausible, and then from this point go on to derive Einstein's equations. And so the middle point is just essentially ADS-CFD. That as I'm going to follow Malda Sain and say the Hilbert space of my theory is going to be the Hilbert space of some CFD. It's a tensor product space. It's a completely ordinary space. And similarly, the Hamiltonian is going to be the Hamiltonian of the CFT. And I'm going to assume at this midpoint, I'm going to assume that for some set of CFT states, these CFT states here are in correspondence with a geometry, which I call M, and some quantum state of a quantum field theory, which lives in the bulk. Right. So this is the boundary theory. This is the bulk geometry and the bulk quantum field theory state. So this is a kind of semi-classical perspective where I have a more or less classical geometry, and I look at small fluctuations or some kind of quantum field theory living on top of this semi-classical geometry. And so an example would be that if I had the CFT ground state, this would be dual to Anthony de Sitter space with all the bulk fields in their vacuum with respect to this time translation. Okay. And I want to emphasize that this geometry can be singled out just on the basis of symmetry. I don't need to solve an equation of motion to postulate this as a starting point. Okay, so I'm not introducing any circularity at this stage. And then the crucial thing, given this data, the crucial statement will be the following. If I have this ADS spacetime or some more general spacetime, so here's X, so this is like the field theory spatial direction. Here's R, this is the radial direction. This is a region A I'm interested in the field theory, in the boundary theory. This is its complement. And I'm told to construct a minimal surface, A tilde, this blue dashed line, which terminates on the boundary. And it has some additional bulk region sigma, which is enclosed by this minimal surface. And I'm told that the entanglement entropy of region A in the CFT state is simply given by the area of this minimal surface in Planck units plus the bulk entanglement entropy of the bulk fields in region sigma. Okay. Now, in the context of ADS-CFT, this leading term was postulated by Ryutaki Nagi and later justified by Malda Sain and Lukovits. Then this subleading term was more recently suggested by Faulkner, Lukovits, and Malda Sain. And you know, this has a long history. It goes back to Sorkin talking about black hole entanglement, black hole entropy being entanglement entropy. But I want to emphasize what I'm going to do is I'm just going to assume this is true. So I just assume this formula is valid. I'm not assuming an equation of motion or anything like that. I'm assuming this formula and that the geometry exists. And from this formula, I will display Einstein's equations. Okay. And there's a lot of discussion of this formula and similar formulas, because there's issues about how to find this quantity. You know, it has a UV divergence in principle, but maybe you can absorb that UV divergence into a renormalization of Newton's constant. But I'm not going to touch on these issues because I don't really need to worry about such things, as you'll see later on.
Those kind of sides also divergent, right?
Yes, so there are two divergences here.
Yeah, there and there.
Yeah, so there's a divergence from the bulk,
yeah,
and a divergence because you go to the asymptotic. So this part is fine, that's physical. But this bulk divergence is what's going to cancel.
The second term is quantum in the bulk. Is that right?
Yeah, it's just the entanglement entropy of the bulk.
Einstein's equations, are you going to use that second term in the play role?
Yes, it will. Yeah, you'll see. Okay. So I call this critical assumption star. And what I'm going to try to do is go from qubits to star, and then from star to Einstein's equations. And what I'll use to do this is tensor networks for this part of the story. And then for this part of the story, it'll just be geometry and some curved space quantum field theory. And I, to be completely honest, we can't go all the way to here yet, as you probably guess. But I hope at least to make it plausible that using tensor networks, one can get very close to the idea of a geometry and that this entanglement formula would be obeyed. And the issue of going all the way there is a technical one.
So the previous slide, are you assuming not just for the ground state,
yeah, let's say I assume it's true. So maybe if I have some really time-dependent geometry, there's an issue about what I do, whether I extremize or minimize or whatever. But let's say for ground states and small perturbations thereof, which is what I'll use, I assume that's true.
So you're assuming a static state? Is that
well, I mean, this is a static situation, but...
Okay. But you're not allowed for black holes.
No, I can have black holes. Yeah, I assume this is true for black holes.
So this could be a thermal state on the boundary.
Yeah, of course, definitely. I won't use that explicitly, but it could be.
So you're assuming real time energy. Why would you expect, on the next slide, why would you expect the generically real time energy would be satisfied in time?
Well, I don't expect that, actually. So that's part of the issue, is that what tensor networks give you is some much more generic thing, which you could perhaps organize as like all kinds of integrals of curvature over this surface right here. So only in some long distance limit where you look at big regions, or if you have a special theory, would you get Ryutaki-Nagi. But if you put something like the Wald entropy here, then things will still work, actually. But I'm just going to focus on Ryutaki-Nagi.
What can you say more about the motivation for this? I thought the motivation for Ryutaki-Nagi was frankly, you're starting with a bulk theory which has your gravitational description, that's where you get Ryutaki-Nagi. So you're putting in. But you want to say there's some more general motivation.
Well, not necessarily more general, but different motivation, yes. A different construction, or an attempt to construct the geometry and to prove directly from this construction that the entropy obeys something like an area law in the bulk geometry. That's what I'm going to do. Okay, so this is the midpoint. So let's do part one. So here, okay, I mentioned qubit, so they had to appear somewhere. So here's a qubit. But I'm immediately going to replace the one qubit with many qubits, because I need to have a large number of degrees of freedom in order to get some kind of, one feels that I need to have a lot of stuff in order to get a nice big geometry. For the same reason I needed to have many low line degrees of freedom to have the radial direction go on for a long distance. You might think that I need to have a lot of degrees of freedom locally to get some kind of semi-classical answer out, right? So this, you can think of this large N, which I'm not specifying more than just saying there's some large number of degrees of freedom on each purple blob. So you see, just made up a bunch of qubits. And you can think of this perhaps as a large N gauge theory, but you don't have to. And I won't be more specific about what I mean by this blue blob or this purple blob. Okay, so then we arrange the purple blobs in some kind of local way. So here I've drawn one dimension. So I have, again, x, my field theory direction, or my quantum many-body direction. And I have these purple blobs arranged in some line. And the Hilbert space of the whole system is just a tensor product of the Hilbert spaces of the individual sites. And I further assume that I have a local Hamiltonian, which I won't specify. But I will assume that it has degrees of freedom at all scales. And I'll assume that in some sense it's strongly interacting, although I won't be more precise about what I mean by this in this talk. This is really starting to get onto these technical issues about trying to really do this program for a particular model, which is very challenging. Okay, so what's the basic idea of what I'm going to do? Let's think about the ground state of the system. I'm assuming it's a CFT, or it's a regulated CFT. And what we'd like to do is represent the ground state in a way which first of all explicitly takes and makes clear the separation of the physics at different length scales. Because we want to kind of see this length scale correspond to some new direction, some new dimension. We want to explicitly take entanglement into account. And we want the entanglement to be represented in some quasi-geometrical way. So the idea is we can just summarize as saying we want to represent the CFT ground state as some kind of entanglement network. And this goes back to the work of Vidal. So here's a picture. So let's start with our degrees of freedom up here. And we want to do renormalization. So here we're going to do some kind of real space renormalization. And the idea is very simple. It says you start with some microscopic degrees of freedom, but they're entangled. But that entanglement is some part long range and some part short range, some part UV sensitive, some part infrared. So what I should do is really remove the local entanglement first, because that's not universal, right? I should somehow coarse grain over it, forget about it. So I try to disentangle things locally. And then when I do that, when I reduce the effective dimension of the density matrix of this site, let's say, then I can take two of these guys and I can coarse grain them into some lower down degree of freedom here and some kind of product state. So the big picture is I take some degrees of freedom, I try to remove local entanglement, so I have some factorized degrees of freedom, which I can then discard, and then I keep some effective infrared degrees of freedom here. And then I repeat the procedure. So I can now group two of the once or normalized degrees of freedom. I can disentangle them. And then again, I can do this other grouping and coarse grain them into something else. So, yeah?
Is this different from this coarse graining of fields? Or?
Well, this is a state. So I'm doing the state here. Uh-huh. So in principle, yeah, it is different from. But let's say it's not completely clear to what extent this reproduces like Wilsonian renormalization of an imaginary time action, let's say. So this is really some kind of state-based renormalization.
You basically are replacing the state by a coarse-grained version of itself.
Yes. Yeah, what I'm really doing is I'm saying applying a certain class of unitary transformations which can remove entanglement. And my goal is to factorize some sort of high-energy degrees of freedom into a product state so that I can forget about them.
Do you have any path integrable understanding of this, or any expression for this entanglement, for this procedure, like renormalization of a path integral?
Yes, I have some. It's not published, but I have some statements I can make. But ask me later. Okay. I don't want to get too derailed here. Right, so it's just saying that you should think about entanglement in the wave function as organized hierarchically. You know, there may be some short range singlets and then singlets between slightly longer range degrees of freedom and slightly longer ranged and so on. So I want to emphasize this is an ansatz. It's just a variational, you can think of it as just a variational representation of the wave function.
Are you going to be dropping things? Or are we doing exactly the approximate course?
Well, so numerically you would do it approximately. Maybe I can do it exactly in some sense if I make these kept degrees of freedom big enough. So for special models, it is exact. But in principle and numerically, I'm dropping stuff.
In the expansion in.
I don't know in general what the expansion is in, but at least in numerically, you know, there's like a number of states I keep, and that's a refinement parameter. So as you make this number of states larger, you would expect that you get a better and better approximation to the ground state. In fact, you can prove that if I make it sufficiently big, I get a good approximation. But I think the important point would be to say that this we believe such a network is, at least for like one-dimensional CFTs, is in the same universality class as the true ground state wave function. And so, for example, you can calculate entropies and scaling dimensions from such a network by optimizing the ground state energy variationally, and then you can get universal data out, and it agrees with known results.
What does MERA stand
for? Multiscale entanglement normalization ansatz. This is Giffre's word, so. Okay, so now I want to discuss an important property of this network. So the interesting thing here, let me just say, is that you sort of have some, you know, you have L sites here, then you have L over 2 sites, and then you have L over 4 sites. So it's kind of hyperbolic. It's going down in this sort of ADS-like way. And an important role is played by what's called the causal structure of MERA. So to understand this, let me just imagine as a device to quick rotate the radial direction so it's like a time. So I'm now thinking of like building the state up as some kind of quantum circuit. So there's something defined as the causal cone of a boundary region, CC of A, which is just all the things in this network, all the tensors and sites, which can affect the state of that boundary region. Right? So you see, if, for example, I'm looking at this state of this guy over here, applying this little unitary doesn't do anything to it, right? Because it's outside of causal contact. But if I'm looking at the state of this thing and I do something down here, well, then it can affect that state. Right? And so a very useful way to picture this in the continuum notation is to think about a de Sitter kind of metric where I interpret time as the radial direction. And so here's the boundary at t T equals zero, or T equals A, some UV regulator. And then here's T equals minus infinity down here. And so the causal cone is just this backwards, everything which can send a signal to A, like this. And the important thing is that although this, the length of this spatial slice here starts out big, it starts out, you know, the order of the region size. When you go down here, once T of R is, you know, once the radial direction is of order L, then this length becomes of order one. So that's a true property of this network, is you start with some degrees of freedom up here, say in this interval. You renormalize a bunch of times, they shrink down to where they're of order one or two sites, and then the causal cone just stays there and fluctuates in the numerical, in the network. Okay. So that property is actually reproduced exactly in this geometry. So then, okay, what I can do, what will be important later is that we want to talk about entanglement, is to talk about A and its complement. So here's A, and here's its complement, and they have their own causal cones. So everything from this solid black line to the dashed black line is the causal cone of A, or some part of it. And everything from the solid red line to the dashed red line is the causal cone of the complement. And so I can define three regions, one of which is what I call the reduced causal cone of A relative to A bar, which is all the things in the causal cone of A that are not in the causal cone of A bar. So it's all the things that can just affect A. Similarly, for the reduced causal cone of A bar relative to A, it's all the things that can just affect A bar and not possibly affect A. And then there's the notion of shared causal cone, which is the things that can affect both. And notice, although this, you know, these are like lines going out, the boundary, the width of this thing is always bounded. It just becomes basically two because I have this, you know, funky metric like this. So it looks like it's a big region, but in proper distance, it's actually just a little small sliver, which goes down. And so we can represent the Mira state like this. We have some network of tensors, which represents the stuff in this reduced causal cone. We have another network for this reduced causal cone of A bar. We have tensors in the shared causal cone. And then these little lines coming out here, and the red boxes represent the state of the bulk degrees of freedom. Right, so remember, I had all these zeros here, and I'm going to call these bulk degrees of freedom. Right, so here everything is just a zero. And so if I take this network and I put in all zeros, that's what this little box means, to every slot in the bottom, then I get out the Mira state, the original Vidal's original Mira. Okay. So now I want to show you some properties using this representation. So first of all, let's ask about entanglement. Okay, so here is, in a network, how you calculate the reduced density matrix. So you have the network for the state, and you put the network for the bra down here, for the, this is the ket and this is the bra, then you connect all the degrees of freedom in A bar, like that, right? And now you can simplify this, because this triangle is just a bunch of unitaries. That's what I showed you in the network. So I can actually remove this triangle and replace it by these lines, which just connect. So here, if you like, this line then goes over here, in there, and this line here comes out and goes around and goes in there. Right? So that's what I'm drawing over here. So these bulk degrees of freedom in the reduced causal cone of A bar relative to A just give nothing. And I have some trace of some indices of this shared causal cone tensor. And then because I'm interested in just in the entanglement entropy, I'm free to conjugate the state via some local unitary. So let me also remove this piece here by conjugating with that unitary transformation. Okay. So you see that this part also doesn't do anything. These are unentangled degrees of freedom. And so the entanglement in this network, that is the entropy of these lines here, only depend on the shared causal cone, right? And then the states I put into it. That's all that matters. And remember, I told you the shared causal cone is some object which has a finite width as you go down. It's sort of order the de Sitter radius or the ADS radius as you go down. So it's really just a property of the boundary between the bulk regions corresponding to A and A bar. And this is how one proves that you have this kind of notion of area law, bulk area law in the Mira network. So for example, if you did this for a 1D CFD, you'd find it that the number of states in this shared causal, the number of regions in this shared causal cone is basically logarithmic in the size of A. So you get something like log L bound on the amount of entropy you can add. Okay. Yeah.
Why the shared causal bound corresponds to the area volume bound?
So all I was trying to say is that the size of the shared causal cone drawn in this way, it looks like it's some big region, but in proper distance, it remains small the entire time, right? And there is it's this thing, right? So the width is 2t. And so in this metric where you have this 1 over t squared, the width is always 2. So it's some, at least at the resolution level of the network, it's always a small strip, which just has some small width and then goes down between the boundary of A and A bar in the bulk. So that's why it's like a bulk area law term. Does that make sense? I can draw a little picture. So in some kind of proper coordinates, the shared causal cone is just basically this. So it's really just a boundary law in this network. If I shrink things down so that the distance on the blackboard is their proper distance and not their, in fact, there's a little, it goes down like this. But if this distance is really the proper distance, then it has this property that it gets smaller. Okay. So this is really essentially an old story. This is the story of my 2009 paper. But what we recently realized is that you can really use these bulk degrees of freedom to do something interesting. So instead of putting all these guys into zeros, you could have some fun with them. So in general, you could have your tensors of your network, but you could also put the bulk degrees of freedom in some non-trivial state like this. And you can't say much in general about the situation. For example, if you made the bulk state just be the inverse of this unitary transformation applied to all zeros, then the state of the theory is just disentangled, right? So there's no completely general statement you can make about the relationship between the entanglement of this network, the entanglement generated by this network, and the entanglement of this state. But in special cases, you can. So for example, suppose I start with the Mira network, where it's all zeros and all zeros and all zeros here. But then I introduce a little bit of entanglement, or any amount of entanglement, between degrees of freedom just in the reduced causal cone of A relative to A bar, and those in the reduced causal cone of A bar relative to A. Right? So like the bulk regions that just belong to A bar and just belong to A, and I entangle those degrees of freedom. Well, then we can prove an easy result. We can prove that the entropy of A is now equal to the area of piece, which is what we got from the Bayer network, plus just the entanglement of these bulk degrees of freedom in the bulk region corresponding to A with those in the bulk region corresponding to A bar. This is easy to prove. And in fact, if you go back to this picture, you just add a little bit of entanglement here, but skipping the middle square, and it immediately follows you get this extra bulk bit. Okay, so the point of the story is at this point is that there is a sense in which you actually in this network do have some kind of area law piece, which is associated with the touching between A and A bar in the bulk. That's sort of the short distance part. But you also have the ability to add bulk entanglement, which is a kind of more long range thing. Okay. And so what we can say in general is, well, we can say a lot, but so let me just say that you can think of it in the following way. You can say the entanglement entropy of region A in the boundary is only different from the entanglement entropy of its bulk corresponding region. It only differs from that by the application of this unitary transformation which acts on the shared causal cone. And from the point of view of the bulk, that's a local thing. You're just doing some local operations along this little region. Now that's normally responsible for all the interesting entanglement. For example, in a CFE, this would be like log L distance, and I get log L entropy. But if I had some entanglement, some longer entanglement between these guys and these guys, it's not affected by acting with local unitary transformations. All right, so there's a sense in which the long-ranged part of the bulk entanglement is preserved via acting with this unitary transformation in the shared causal cone. So let me give you just an example, rather than trying to make a very general statement. Suppose in the bulk I have some fermionic degrees of freedom, right? Maybe it's a CFT and a large in CFT and I add a small chemical potential. So I have some fermionic mesons or something, or hadrons of some type, right? And then we could say, we could, for example, put the bulk degrees of freedom into a Fermi liquid in the bulk. That would be fine. And what you would find is that the entropy indeed obeys a formula like this. There's the area law piece, which comes just from the network, and then some long distance piece coming from the bulk degrees of freedom, which would actually be like the Fermi liquid entanglement. So it would actually scale faster than the area law piece at very large sizes. It would be like L squared log L in two dimensions. So that's not, and that long range entanglement is not affected by the presence of this little short circuit. Similarly, if I had, you know, if I just had singlets, you know, an A bar or something like that, it would not be affected. Or if I had a thermal state in the bulk, this would change a little bit the entanglement around the boundary, around this region here. But it wouldn't affect the fact that there's an extensive entropy in this region or this region.
So such a thing can't be dual with the ground state of the local Hamiltonian in the boundary?
Sorry, which can't be dual?
The state you just described.
Yeah, it would be some thermal state where you only have a few degrees of freedom excited. So like if it was a confining large N gauge theory, and you wanted to have an approximation of the thermal state where you only excite a few Goldstone modes or something like that, then you could describe that as like a short, some kind of circuit, which does the large N part, and on top of that, put the Goldstone, the bulk degrees of freedom, in some other state.
Because Fermi surface is definitely described as like log L.
Oh yeah, the Fermi surface, yes. You would have to modify the network in a non-trivial way to incorporate the Fermi surface geometrically. Okay. So there are some additional statements I can make about some kind of crude large N model, but very, very crude, but let me not worry about that. So let me just kind of summarize the section and say, clearly, I haven't derived any geometry or anything, but let me say that I hope it's at least plausible or not completely crazy to suppose that a geometry where there's some kind of area piece plus entanglement of bulk degrees of freedom could emerge from this description.
So, I mean, that's not only true of large N, that separation.
Yeah. So in general, it, depending on, as I said, you know. You can, if you make this state crazy enough, you can completely undo the effect of the network, right? But just by making the state be the reverse of whatever unitary transformation you're applying to it.
Actually, coming from the bulk, I mean, the only reason that the Ryu-Takinagi entanglement is separable
yes.
than the bulk entanglement is because of large N. So yes. There shouldn't be an argument that doesn't say large N.
No, I have to say large N.
But you've made an argument. I mean,
no. What I've said is something very, very crude from that. This is really like, you know, a size ADS radius, right? So that's extremely, you know, it's not like string scale or some short distance. It's very non-local, very fuzzy.
But at that level, the separation should. The separation should only make sense with the word large N in the sentence somewhere.
Well, I think we don't know what it looks like actually on the gravity side. I mean, this is a theorem about this network. Now, is there a sense in which on the gravity side, if you looked at regions much larger than the ADS radius, there's a sense in which there's something like an area piece and some semi-classical geometry in which there's a field theory or something like that. I don't know. Maybe that's crazy, but it's not obvious to me that it's
true. That is true for objects moving around. In the sense that CFT states look like objects moving around in ADS that decouple at distances much bigger than the ADS radius.
Okay.
So that would support this statement about fuzzy, as long as the fuzziness is ADS radius or bigger.
Yeah. So my general understanding of this whole thing is that what this locality and so forth is saying is really if you go beyond ADS scales, everything, every theory has this property, roughly speaking. how true that is, I don't know, but it's not obviously falsified, I think, by what we know about ADS-CFT away from large N.
It's also, you mentioned the word CFT many times, but you didn't, it wasn't clear to me that you were using any part of Lorentz invariance or scale.
I'm really not. I'm using scale invariance. That's about it, in translation invariance.
Okay. But if you're not using Lorentz invariance at all, you would think you could go into the bulk theory, you could just put in some non-local term by hand, and you know, you'll get some scale invariant boundary theory. It's not clear to me how your assumptions would kill that possibility.
Well, I'm not sure. It depends on what you mean by non-local. Like, if you accept my interpretation, this should be, you know, the sites of this network should be viewed as like ADS sized chunks. Then maybe it's non-local below that scale. That could be true. I can't rule it out. But beyond that scale, it looks like it is local just from the fact that the Hamiltonian at the boundary is local. So I have local terms Hamiltonian. They produce some short-range entanglement primarily. I can remove that entanglement. And then I renormalize, and I still have a local Hamiltonian left over.
Sure. And you would want something which is local sort of in the Poincaré directions, but non-local in what we think of the Z direction. So it wouldn't destroy locality and boundary theory. Lorentz and Norman conformal invariance would kill that because that translates into something with ADS.
No, I do think there is something about scale invariance, which is, I don't necessarily know if I need the full power of the conformal group to make the statement that you're making. Right. The statement that there's some that my construction is explicitly of the type that I just do things locally scale by scale. So I never like couple degrees of freedom at very short scales and very long scales directly in the network. Right. So I'm not gonna try to rule that out on any kind of general grounds, but at least in this construction that kind of coupling just doesn't happen. We can talk later if you'd like to help me understand more what you mean. So the summary of part one is just that we have these networks, and they have some kind of emergent direction, emergent dimension, which is associated with scale. And the network encodes entanglement in some quasi-geometrical way. And the network is dynamical. It depends on the state. And I told you especially today about this new physics of bulk entanglement we've been thinking about. And then I didn't talk about, but one would really expect that if you had some Hamiltonian lattice model of n equals 4 or something like that, that you could do this. There's no obstruction to doing this network. And in that case, by looking in detail at the properties of these tensors, you could really convince yourself that you had effectively some kind of smooth geometry emerging. But that's not something we can achieve yet. Yeah?
So what do you mean by network is dynamical?
I just mean it depends on the state. So, I mean, I could view this as a variational ansatz, and I could do, you know, I could just apply Schrodinger's equation to it and write equations of motion for the unitaries. That's perfectly fine. But it's a bit clumsy, but it can be done. Yeah?
For the equation that you mentioned, the star one, you're assuming it for any dimension for the boundary, because you're using Mira, and Mira is usually for one dimensional.
Well, no, I'm okay. Yeah, I'm drawing pictures in 1D, but I think it works in higher dimensions as well. I mean, numerically it's challenging, but conceptually there's no obstruction to producing a Mira for a 2+1 dimensional CFT. At least I don't know of one. If you have one, I'd love to hear about it. But yeah.
What determines the degrees of freedom in this box? And how many fields, what kind of fields you have?
That depends.
How many is related to the...
It depends on the dynamics. So, I mean, in principle, this is just a unitary transformation, which is transforming some degrees of freedom to some other degrees of freedom. And so it's just some exact unitary transformation. But yeah, you'd like to say in some special limit that there are maybe few bulk degrees of freedom, for example.
Yeah.
So, for example, you can use these tensors to calculate scaling dimensions, and you maybe like to imagine you're in a situation where there are very few low-lying operators, right? And so then it would make sense to restrict attention to bulk degrees of freedom, which are only composed of these low-lying operators. Those are kind of the natural ones to use. And so that's some small subset of, but this is a model-dependent statement. Mm-hmm. So I can't yet show you in general how this decomposition would appear and what exactly it looks like.
You can imagine some correspondence between eigenoperators of the dilatation operator
yes.
and the bulk
figures. Yeah, so I mean in some crude model that I mentioned here, what happens is most you can renormalize operators by applying one layer of the network to them. And most operators have a very large scaling dimension in the sense that they essentially get wiped out. They just get put to one or put to their trace. And only a few operators have a small dimension, so that they survive.
But they might be protected by
something. Yeah, they may be protected for whatever reason, right? They may have some. So they survive one step of the RG. And these are the natural ones to put in these bulk degrees of freedom in that case, right? The ones that the other ones are participating in some strongly mixing dynamics, and you can't really access them very easily. They immediately get swept away into the network. But these protected ones, these ones that don't, that have small dimension, they survive and can move around in some nice way. They can move around through the network. Yeah.
For each local degree of freedom, you have a lot of qubits. So
yes.
This is a large entity, right? And so what if you don't have this kind of assumption that you are working on the project?
Yeah, so in that case, I mean, the network can still be done. But as we were discussing before, there's just a question of interpretation. You know, if I interpret these pieces of the network as like large ADS-sized, you know, I have a gravity dual, you know, in quotes, where there's a zillion fields and there's not any kind of bulk locality on small scales, or just some very fuzzy thing that fluctuates. You know, that may be what that equals, but that's, you know, hard to make precise. But as a numerical method, it can be done. And in fact, that's where it has been done, because we can't we don't have large end computers, unfortunately. Yeah, okay, that's a good question. So the way it's reflected in one way is that in principle, the amount of entanglement added by these transformations, these unitaries, depends on what state you put into them, right? But at least in a crude model of this large n limit, what happens is that the amount of entropy added by the network becomes independent of the state. So whatever state you put in, the entropy added is always the same. So one could interpret that as a non-fluctuating, you know, entropy is non-fluctuating in that situation, which if we identify entropy in geometry, suggests that geometry is also non-fluctuating. Exactly. Yes. Yeah. Okay, so let me go ahead and go on to the second part. Understatement of the year, a slight leap from the previous discussion. We're going to go back to this geometry and entanglement perspective. Okay. So no more networks if you don't like networks. I hope it at least, if not plausible, you know, made it a suggestive case in the previous section that it's not crazy to imagine you have a geometry here, which has some entities that are like form, and that entanglements could take, in some special case, the form of an area term plus some bulk entanglement. But whatever, I'm going to start from this assumption, and then I'm going to show you this implies that Einstein's equations must also hold. Okay. So I want to do dynamics. I mean, on real-time dynamics here. So using my correspondence between CFT states and bulk geometries, I assume that some small change in the CFT state is reflected as some small change in the geometry and some small change in the bulk state. Right, so on the CFT side, I start with the ground state, and I add a small amount of any other state. And on the gravity side, I add a small metric perturbation and a small change in the bulk state.
Did your previous argument give you the dt squared term as well?
Well, it's really just a picture of space, but you can figure out what dt squared has to be by looking at the renormalization of the Hamiltonian, which is contained in the network. But I don't really have a network which represents space-time directly. So it's really a very kind of spatial representation, like a fixed time slice. Okay, so this is the setup. And what we're going to do is use what's been called the CFT first law. And we're going to use it for regions. We're going to consider regions A, which are balls of some radius r, centered at some point x naught. And for this situation, actually, the bulk region turns out to be a hemisphere. So that's a very nice setup. And what we're going to do is we're going to take this state variation of the state. We're going to look at the entropy of these balls. And we're going to compute the change in the entropy. And it turns out you can show that this change in entropy is related to the change in some energy-like quantity, which is defined here. So here's delta EB. There's a factor of 2 pi, some weird weighting factor, and the CFT stress tensor. Okay, this was, I think, as far as I know, this first appeared in a paper in Communications Mathematical Physics, Hislop and Longo many years ago, talking about free scalar fields. And then very much more recently, Cassini, Myers, and Huerta have made a very beautiful general argument for this. It's essentially a version of unreal radiation, where you have some, so it's saying that the, you know, here it's like saying that the change in entropy is the change in the log of the density matrix. So the density matrix is like E to some energy. This is the change in that energy. So this is saying the density matrix of that region is like a thermal state with respect to this energy. Okay. So yeah, why is this B special? Why do we choose this particular region? And related to the reason why we can make this first law statement is precisely because the region B supports a conformal killing vector, which is, I write down for you here. The bulk region sigma B supports a bulk killing field, which is right here. And then this surface B tilde is actually the bifurcation surface of this killing horizon. So this is a very special region where essentially the boundary of it in the bulk is like a black hole horizon, which is why we have these special properties.
Can you go back?
Yeah. Oh, so I just changed all the, so from here, from henceforth, I'm going to use B because I'm specializing to a particular situation. Sorry if that was confusing. But actually, I drew the correct region. So it's these hemispheres are always B tildes.
And it's extended time, right?
Well, no, this is at some fixed time. So there's a T naught. I pick a particular T naught and then do it.
So wait, so you're just saying that if you have a ball in the boundary, then the minimal surface in the bulk will be such that you can fill it in with a conformal killing field for which that's the bifurcation.
So there's a killing field here, which asymptotes the conformal killing field here, and the minimal surface is the bifurcation surface of this bulk killing field.
Meaning where it intersects the boundary.
No, I mean the entire.
But that's what I said, but you seem to correct me.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to correct you. I misunderstood.
So the killing field is in the.
Maybe, I think maybe we use boundary in two different ways.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, this blue thing is the bifurcation surface.
Right.
Of the bulk killing field. And then you also have this boundary conformal killing field where it goes to zero.
Right.
Yeah. Is that, are we on the same page? Okay.
So where in the CFT, first of all, do you use the fact of the CFT?
Oh, well, because it's a conformal killing vector, not a killing vector. Mm-hmm. So it's not, so I need the fact that it's a CFT that doesn't care about conformal transformations to derive this formula here. So this is, if you look here, that's this piece, r squared minus x squared. That's what appears here. So what I needed, you know, unlike for the half space, let's say, where it's just a killing field, the boost, you know, the boost generator, here I really need the CFTness. Okay. So here's how it works. And let me just say, this is work first. This part is first talked about by Mark Van Ramsdonk and his group, and then put in a very nice formulation by Rob Myers and his collaborators, and it really builds on old work of Iyer and Wald. And again, I think you'll see it's spiritually very similar to Jacobson's argument. So let's just forget about the entanglement entropy, the bulk entanglement entropy part for a second, and just focus on the geometrical part. So the statement that you can make is that there exists some form, which is basically just a function of the small change in the metric, such that the area variation, the variation of this B tilde in the geometry is the integral over b tilde of this form. And the reason why that's true is because the variation with respect to the surface vanishes because it's minimal. So this formula can change in two ways. It can change because b tilde changes and because m changes, but the variation of b tilde is zero, the first order, because it's minimal. And now similarly, you can use the dictionary, holographic dictionary, or you can actually derive it by applying this thing to small balls near the edge. But you can also show that the change in the entropy can be written in gravitational variables as an integral over b. So an integral over this top bit up here, sort of asymptoting to the boundary. So this gives you delta EB, this gives you delta S. And it's the same thing. And furthermore, this form has the nice property that its derivative is this Killing field, some volume form, and then this little object here is the linearized Einstein equation without matter. So it's just, so you calculate the Einstein equation from this, and then you linearize it about ADS. And that's what this is. Okay. Now, what about the,
maybe it's on the next slide. So the contribution of the bulk field?
Here we go. So what about the bulk degrees of freedom? So they have some bulk state. And just by general, again, the general rules, all I'm doing is I'm saying that for anything whatsoever, delta S of rho is minus trace delta rho log rho. I'm just taking a derivative. But I know what this log rho is, right? Here's the log of rho sigma, because precisely this region sigma is itself like a Rindler wedge, basically, in the bulk, an ADS Rindler wedge. So essentially, by the same argument that let me get the CFT first law for the conformal Killing field, I can get this bulk first law, if you like, using the ordinary Killing field. So here's the Killing field, here's the bulk stress tensor, and here's the volume form, and integrate over the bulk region. Okay, so I have that this important formula here, that the change in the bulk entropy is this integral over the bulk region sigma b. Okay, so here's the main argument. So I start with the CFT first law, 0 equals delta S minus delta E. Then I translate to gravitational variables. So the gravitational dictionary analogs of these quantities also equals 0. And then I use the calculated variations. So I have this integral over b tilde of chi, integral over b of chi with a minus sign, and then this bulk bit here, which comes from the bulk entropy. Then I use Stokes' theorem. I combine b tilde and b. Right, here's b tilde. Here's b. So I do b tilde minus b. I have a complete integral. Right. So then I can use the formula for the derivative of this form chi to have, at the end of the day, just one big integral over the bulk region sigma. The Killing field is in front, the volume form is in back, and I have the linearized Einstein equations without matter plus a variation of the bulk stress tensor.
Let me get to the punchline. Can you say again where that linearized
Einstein
comes from?
I didn't explain where it came from. I just said that I just claimed that if you take this, you can find a form with these two properties such that its derivative is this. I didn't justify that, I just stated it. If you like, well, you know better than I why this is true, but.
In my context, it's a very different reason why it comes up. In the context I was looking at it, you know, you used the focusing equation.
Yes.
Nothing like that is happening.
Yeah. I think if you assumed Einstein's equations were true and then plug this in, I think you would get something similar to what you considered. But maybe this.
I think instead of a wall derivation, there's two boundary terms, but to get between them, you need the equations of motion.
Yeah.
I can't tell you, because he computing.
He's but, yeah, he's he looks like he's enlightened now, so so thanks, Rob. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's essentially something like that.
Is it a dramatic statement that this variation is equal to this Einstein?
Is which one a dramatic statement?
No, the last one, the deep guy.
Oh, this, yeah, that's geometrical. Just geometry.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's essentially, you know, you calculate the variation of the area, mm-hmm. and then you can push it through to the boundary.
Is it a high U-guy that you also have variation of area, right?
So you have like an area of non-base, a complex non-base.
Yeah, but it's a really different reason. I think this has much more to do with the nether current. For,
yeah, that's true.
Than anything else. It's just,
yes.
The
I would agree with that statement.
The area on one side and the energy on the other side are the
right.
are all you get when you integrate the nether current.
Yes, I would agree with that statement, yeah.
Is this true for any Cauchy surface in the bulk, or is there some assumption about what the time coordinate's doing?
Is there some assumption what the time coordinate is doing? Well, I mean, okay.
Some fixed time in the CFT, but how do you know what time in the bulk this course your surfaces are living on? Or is it just any?
Well, yeah, it's anything in this causal domain, right?
Okay.
That, yeah, it doesn't matter. Okay. Yes. Right, so we got this formula. Okay, so we went through the CFT first law. We got all the way to this point. Okay, now the punchline is, with fanfare, this is true for all balls at all times and all positions. So you can argue, not completely trivially, but you can argue that the integrand vanishes. That gives you essentially like the zero, zero component of this equation for some fixed time slice. Then you can do boosts. That gives you all the field theory directions. And then the other directions turn out to be constraints, right? So the fact that if this equation is true in the field theory directions, and you have conservation of the CFT stress tensor and its tracelessness, then you can show that the R mu and RR components are also valid. Okay, so they're just constraints that if obeyed at the boundary are obeyed in the bulk, provided the mu nu components are obeyed.
This is the fixed time you assumed already.
No, I think I assumed it. Well, I'm not sure exactly how much I assumed it before, but I certainly used a lot of properties of these killing fields and so forth to derive this. So maybe you could actually make a general statement, a more general statement, with some other kinds of dynamics, but I haven't thought about it.
So I guess you assume ADS geometry.
Yeah, I was starting with a CFT ADS, and I'm making small perturbations about it. So then at the end of the day, what do we get? We get the linearized Einstein equation equals the bulk stress tensor. Okay, which is the equivalence principle, the fact that all matter couples to gravity universally just by its stress tensor. And that really here, that's coming from somehow the statement that what matters is just the entanglement entropy of all the bulk degrees of freedom. They all contribute to that thing, so they all contribute to gravity. Okay, so let me just make a very brief detailed an interpretation comment about this thing. So what does this equation really mean? The first thing I'd like to say is that the right-hand side includes, in principle, the graviton. The graviton should be included amongst the bulk field that you're considering as the on top of this background. And so, in fact, there is a graviton stress tensor contribution in here. So the theory is already nonlinear. You can't get away from that, even if you just had a graviton. If I try to interpret this thing as something like a statement about let's imagine there's some operator equation which relates the operator metric fluctuation with some source operator, which I don't know, and some unknown kernel. Right, then I can interpret this equation as telling me that the kernel, this equation is actually essentially matrix elements of this equation between the vacuum and any other state. That's what this little delta gives you. And so what you can interpret this equation as telling you is that the kernel has to be the kernel coming from Einstein gravity, and that the source term is just the bulk stress tensor, plus some other operator O prime with the property that all of its matrix elements between the ground state and the other state are zero. Okay, so it annihilates the ground state from the left and the right. And one can argue very easily that if you assume that O prime has to be local, then this is impossible. So O prime just has to be zero. So really, as an operator statement, we could conclude that it's Einstein gravity. The Einstein kernel acting on H gives you the bulk stress tensor as a quantum operator. At least that's one interpretation of what this equation would mean.
So far, you only argued this for the first variation.
Yes.
From the vacuum. So that claim you just made about the graviton stress tensor doesn't seem supported yet.
No, no. I mean, I'm including only the first. So the left-hand side is the classical, like some coherent state of gravitons, which changes the metric. And then the right-hand side is actually doesn't receive contributions from that. It's not like taking the classical. It's not like doing h squared over g, which is like the stress tensor of the graviton, putting in the classical coherent state. It's like adding a few gravitons. And so I'm saying that, but that, I think that does contribute because they contribute to entanglement entropy in the bulk. I think that they have to contribute.
I see. Your delta H was just the bulk.
It was everything in the bulk, including the gravitons. Yeah. It was everything in the bulk, including the gravitons. Sorry, okay, so maybe say your question again. And
changing the metric, it's not the gravitons.
Well, you can imagine, I have the zero, and I can add a single graviton, right? But I can also add, other gravitons, some other whatever coefficients. Right? So this is like, if you think of this is like the changes the metric, and this part can be thought of as contributing to the stress tensor. Because this part doesn't give anything to the stress tensor.
Don't you really mean some coherency?
Well, of course that's what I really mean is a coherent state. But I'm linearizing everything, so it's the same.
Now, you have this splitting into classical and quantum.
Yes.
Yeah? So what is the Planck constant in this case? I mean, what really defines the splitting? Parameter.
Well, it's Newton's constant, or some Planck or something like that. There's an H bar in there. Yeah, I mean, what I'm doing, I think makes sense. I'm just taking a geometry, which I change slightly, which I can or cannot, if I wish, interpret that as a coherent state of gravitons on top of the old geometry. And in addition to that, I'm also adding, I have a bulk field theory on top of that geometry, which includes the gravitons, and I can add where I can change the state of that bulk field theory however I want.
If you do it mathematically with a small parameter, you have some way to decide whether you give that parameter to the metric part or the other part, and in this linearized expansion, you can't have both ways.
But you can. These things can be the same order. And this contributes, this is like contributing to the delta E, and this contributes to the graviton stress tensor. That's all there is to it. There's no reason why they have to be different orders.
The second term is just a correction to the one-point function, which is the background field.
Yes, yes. That's one way of saying it. What I'm putting over here is all the tadpole-less stuff. But we can discuss it afterwards, but I'm pretty sure this makes sense. Okay. So, and let me just make a comment about nonlinear extension. I claim that the only local nonlinear action which is consistent with our assumption about entanglement at the beginning, star, and this linearized equation is the nonlinear Einstein action. So this is like it's similar in spirit to the bootstrap arguments that say once you couple matter and gravity, they have to somehow bootstrap themselves into some interesting interacting theory, which may, with some assumptions, be Einstein's equations. There are assumptions that go into that argument. So here all we're saying is that if the action is local, an original entanglement assumption plus this linearized equation that only can come from Einstein. That's all we're saying. So in particular, we're not justifying the assumption of locality. I'm just saying that if you assume a local bulk action, this is what it has to be.
But so this is only linear
linearly around, linear perturbations around ADS, right? So if, say for example, I have something like y less squared, which is vanishes in ADS. So that wouldn't, I mean, that would be missing from this.
No, so you're right. The linearized equation only knows about, but I also assumed this sort of static property of entanglements. So if I had a vial squared or something like that, I think that would show up in the entanglement of some more general geometry.
But you, isn't your analysis just limited to ADS?
No, I also assumed at the beginning, my assumption was the entanglement had some form. So that's a very strong assumption. And if I, so what I'm really saying is the assumption the entanglement has a certain form is enough to completely fix the bulk action at the nonlinear level. Because first we can figure out this linearized thing, and then combine with the statement that in the general situation, the entanglement has this area law form, like if you have a black hole or whatever, then that those two pieces of information suffice to pick out Einstein uniquely.
Does it mean that it gets exactly that, or there are higher?
Well, I mean, this is the gravitational part of it, but.
Yeah, no, but in higher order directions, like R squared, and square, and so on.
No, you just get that.
That's zero.
So if I had done, instead of the area law, I had done walled entropy, then I would have the higher curvature theory here. Okay, so it really just depends on what I assume the entanglement looks like. If I assume area, I get Einstein. If I assume something more complicated, I get the higher curvature theory. Yeah, I think what you could say it that way. You could say I'm assuming that there's really a geometry, not like some coordinate patch or something like that. So I'm assuming there's a geometry. Okay, so I'm basically out of time. Let me just summarize. I told you that if you assume the existence of a geometry and a certain representation of entanglement, then you get out of that the linearized Einstein equations universally coupled to matter. And if that's universal coupling, the equivalence principle comes because of the universality of entanglement. Okay. And I also told you the only nonlinear local action consistent with 1 and 2 is Einstein's action. And then building on work that Rob Myers and company did, you can extend this to higher curvature theories. And it seems to work fine. All right, so let me summarize and conclude. I argued, or I hope to have convinced you, that there's some kind of, I think, pretty clear conceptual route now where we can start from macroscopic degrees of freedom. And in the right model, in which we can prove that this geometry exists, and entanglement has a certain form, then Einstein's equations necessarily have to follow. A really interesting thing which I'm getting excited about, I think, is to try to address this model-dependent issue about showing you really have this locality and smooth geometry by bringing in ideas of the CFT bootstrap. Because I think this is something which hasn't been investigated at all in the context of these networks, but really may help us understand what these tensors are doing and how they're, you know, what their structure looks like. Another interesting thing is using the bulk entanglement may be useful actually computationally in condensed matter applications, because you know, in the holographic context, there's a probe approximation where you leave the geometry fixed, but you let the bulk fields fluctuate a little bit. So you can imagine just arbitrarily picking, like if you had a U1 or something like that, some symmetry, you could just pick a network and then keep only the bulk gauge field degrees of freedom and do a numerical simulation where you let those evolve in time in some way, right? And maybe you get some interesting approximation to the CFT dynamics. So then there's a lot of exciting things to do. So to conclude, I think we're getting close to destroying this problem. Maybe by the time the Star Wars movie comes out, we'll have figured it out. So thank you. Yes.
Could you say a little more about the counting powers of n in that equation? So like
yes.
Sean, I'm a little bit bothered by the fact that, you know, I usually think of the Einstein Hilbert term as a tree level term, and then there's other things that are like...
Yeah, it's a 1 over n correction.
But the reason that it can be a true equation and we can ignore the next term, for example, is that in the solution of the equation, the h that you're putting in is sufficiently small. Is that the right idea?
Well, no, I think it's really it's like a semi-classical expansion, right? I mean, if I had h bar, okay, or large n, it's like there's an n squared piece and then an order one piece, and this expansion, as Sean was talking about, may break down very strongly when you don't have any kind of large n parameter. On the other hand, if you look at sufficiently large regions, maybe you recover effectively. If I look at the state of large chunks of space, so if their action is all, the action of such a configuration is always large, then that may be effectively like a small h bar.
Do we know how to compute the next term?
Formally, sure. I mean, you just do a gravitational path integral with some boundary condition. What's so big of a deal about that? I think in 2+ or 1+1, so 2+1 bulk, we may have more power, or what this means. But more generally, I don't think there's a useful statement that I'm aware of yet about what the second correction would look like. But
maybe. It'd be nice to see it break.
Yeah.
Let's meet back at 4:15.